Hi, I'm Connie Loizis.
And this is Alex Gove.
And this is Strictly VC Download. Happy Friday! It is September 18th. Alex and I are ready to have a cold, frosty beer to end the week. But before we do that, we are going to run you through the week's news, after which we hope you will enjoy our interview with this week's guests, the Chainsmokers. Yes, those Chainsmokers. The superstar DJ duo has a new venture fund, and they told us all about it. But first, the U.S. administration versus TikTok and WeChat. Let's dive in.
Donald Trump's Get Tough policy against Chinese technology companies entered a new phase today. The news for TikTok was better than it could have been. Beginning Sunday, the U.S. government will prevent downloads of the entertainment app from U.S.-based app stores. However, it will not stop transactions on the platform until November 12th. Trump also said he had talked to executives from Oracle and Walmart, which are reportedly discussing a plan to take a majority stake in a new company that would oversee TikTok's operations and ensure its data security. Trump had previously demanded that ByteDance sell TikTok to an American company or exit the U.S. market completely. Unfortunately, WeChat's owner, the digital colossus Tencent, doesn't seem to have Larry Ellison's connections at the White House. Effective this Sunday, the Commerce Department will ban U.S. companies from providing the mobile chat payment platform with data hosting services, and it will also prohibit U.S. citizens from using WeChat to transfer money. These moves are tantamount to a death sentence for the U.S. version of WeChat, which is popular with millions of Chinese Americans, many of whom use it to send money back to their relatives in China. An insider told the Wall Street Journal that the U.S. appears to be on the verge of requiring Chinese companies to store data on U.S. citizens in the U.S., much as the Chinese government insists that American companies host data on Chinese citizens in China. Nevertheless, absent a formal policy, confusion reigns. A senior commerce official declined to explain to the journal how the new rules would be enforced or whether it would impose monetary penalties for violations. As Donald Trump might say, it is what it is. The IPO market is hot these days, but is that a good thing? On Wednesday, Snowflake, a cloud-based data management company, went public and soared 112% over its offering price. The company ended up raising $4 billion in capital, and its market cap is now $67 billion. So far, so good? Well, maybe not. The low offering price of $120 effectively meant that the company left $3.8 billion on the table. Sure, Snowflake's price pop garnered tons of press. And it is true that good PR is expensive, but is it worth billions? Not according to Benchmark GP Bill Gurley. In many ways, Snow is the final proof of just how broken the process is, he tweeted. Frank Slootman is a highly experienced IPO CEO. He knows the game and pushed hard to make sure he wasn't shortchanging the company, but it didn't matter because the process is set up to deliver this silliness. Snowflake's IPO left more money on the table than any other U.S. company since Visa went public in 2008. Visa's IPO investors made off like bandits, scoring $5 billion in profits. Maybe Snowflake's bankers should have smelled a rat when Warren Buffett's Berkshire Hathaway, long loath to invest in technology companies, decided to take part in Snowflake's IPO. Whatever the case, Snowflake's IPO will give more ammo to fans of direct listings and SPACs. Connie, what are you hearing from VCs?
Interestingly, of the two, it feels like the SPACs have investors more captivated right now. Maybe that's just because so many of them are being raised. It's kind of hard not to pay attention, whereas we're only seeing a small smattering of direct listings. This week, I talked, for example, with Roelof Botha of Sequoia Capital, whose firm saw three of its portfolio companies go public this week via the traditional route, Sumo Logic, Unity, and Snowflake. Sequoia doesn't have a company that's going public via a direct listing or SPAC yet, but he did note that the fear of the unknown with SPACs, which have been around for 25 years and haven't really performed so well historically, seems to be fading a bit as the players behind these things are changing. Reid Hoffman of LinkedIn and Mark Pincus of Zynga, for example, just raised $600 million for their SPAC this week. Meanwhile, Dana Grayson of Construct Capital, who I interviewed separately, noted that one of her portfolio companies, Desktop Metal, chose to go public via a SPAC, and she sounded really enthusiastic about them. Last but not least, Chamath Palihapitiya, the founder of Social Capital, who started banging the drum about SPACs back in 2017, announced this week that his second SPAC will be merging into the privately held real estate company Opendoor. And according to Bloomberg, he has filed confidentially for a fourth SPAC and apparently has upwards of 20 more of these things up his sleeve. As he suggested in a podcast that he hosts with other investors called All In, he sees the biggest financial opportunity right now, not in writing small checks to little startups, but focusing on the many mature but still private companies out there that just need a little push to get them onto the public markets. He's very happy to give it to them. We'll see who else joins him. In admittedly less hard-hitting news, I had the amazing privilege today of being able to interview Conan O'Brien at the TechCrunch Disrupt Show. Interestingly, no one on his team asked who else was coming to this thing, which is basically the first question out of the mouth of any team that works with a celebrity. They also never tried to pin me down regarding what I would ask, which is also very routine. I think that's because Conan has surrounded himself with a really solid group of people, but also I think he readily agreed to speak at the event because of his son, who is 14 and is super into tech. In fact, he kidded that his son's dream would be to be part of the conference, and he said that his son's depressed that he's part of it because he's worried that his dad is going to drag the whole thing down and make it uncool. Whatever the driver, it was a sheer joy to interview him about being an entrepreneur, which is really why I reached out to him in the first place. People think of Conan O'Brien, the talk show host of 25 plus years, but ever since the late night debacle of 2010, when NBC gave him Jay Leno's spot so Jay Leno could move to primetime, then asked for it back when no one really cared about Jay Leno's primetime show, Conan has been building up a pretty nice business. He appreciated much earlier than some of his peers the power of the internet and meeting his audience online. His company, Team Coco, has something like 10 million YouTube followers. Conan himself has around 30 million followers on Twitter. They are executive producing a number of shows, including those of up-and-coming comics. He also has been building up a network of podcasts, all of which are really, really good. He started his own podcast, Conan Needs a Friend, 2 years ago, and it's hands down my favorite podcast. But Team Coco now oversees 10 podcasts altogether, including one by Rob Lowe, another by Andy Richter, and another by two of his show's longtime writers. It would be easy to imagine that Conan, who for the last 10 years has continued doing a late night show on TBS, would just forget about TV altogether and focus on his other business interests. But when I asked him about this today, he said it's a mistake to think of it in such a binary way. He really wants to do it all and simultaneously. And I think if someone comes along with the right offer and under the right circumstances, whether it's Spotify or Apple or Amazon, that might work too. But he said that first and foremost, he wants to love what he's doing every day. And that is the case right now. In any case, if you're a fan of Conan O'Brien and want to peek into what he's building, do check out our conversation over at TechCrunch's website. He was just such a treat to talk with.
Up next, the Chainsmokers. But first, a word from our sponsor.
Affinity has become the new standard for managing relationships and increasing deal flow. Using patented technology, Affinity helps teams manage and grow their networks by eliminating manual data entry and unlocking introductions to key decision makers. In industries where success is contingent upon maintaining high-touch relationships, Affinity allows you to get deeper insights into your network so you can more easily open doors and close deals. You can learn more at affinity.co or listen to their new podcast, Capital Connections, where they interview top investors about how their network influenced their success. Find Capital Connections on Spotify or Apple Podcast. And now our conversation with the Chainsmokers, founded by Alex Paul and Drew Taggart. They were joined in the conversation by Milan Koch. The three of them, along with Jeffrey Evans, have formed a venture fund called Mantis, and they told us all about it. So we are so excited to be joined by Grammy Award-winning artists, Alex Paul and Drew Taggart today. Guys, there's obviously a lot to talk about, but I thought it was sort of interesting timing that you wrapped up your World War Joy tour in February. Did you have any sense that COVID was coming, that it was a thing, or was that just sort of, you know, coincidence?
Actually, it ended in December. Just totally naturally, that was the end of the tour. We did have like a full year of shows planned for this year.
Did you?
That obviously, you know, were canceled. But, you know, that was obviously, you know, the right thing to do. And I think our last show was actually in Vegas on Valentine's Day. And that was the, you know, the last time I think everyone got together as a group. So obviously it's a shame, but, you know, we're confident that in, you know, the coming months or early next year, we'll start returning to the live stage. So hopefully that's the case.
Well, I know you're very much missed, including by many friends of mine who are avid concert goers. Are you doing much online right now?
As in like virtual events?
Yeah.
We haven't actually. We do 50 shows a year at the Wynn in Las Vegas every year. But besides that, that was pretty much our only commitment for this year. We were planning on, even before COVID, to take off a lot of time, respectively to how often we usually tour, to just focus on our next album.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I'd seen your Instagram message about that earlier this year. You're certainly not lacking in things to do. You have a big business that you've been building beyond just being these, again, Grammy Award-winning DJs. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're involved with exactly?
Sure. So, you know, it was funny when Drew and I met probably 9 years ago, almost to the date, actually. Congrats, Drew. We made it. We got together over our love for dance music. We were obsessed with the genre and really wanted to be a part of it. But we also, in getting to know each other in the beginning, it was very clear that we were both really entrepreneurial and we wanted to use music as an opportunity to get into other areas that were of interest to us. Over those 9 years, we learned that the things we wanted to get into and need to get into had to be inherent to the things we were already doing. So one of the first things we did was we started a TV and film production company, which was really exciting for us because we're very inspired by that space. It's a space we look to for a lot of creativity. And then we also partnered with a tequila company. Naturally, you can imagine the fit there. Tequila is the lifeblood of a chain smoker show. And we wanted to create a brand that was inclusive, but also felt like it spoke to a new generation of drinkers. In college, for me, tequila was like the last thing you drank. But now I feel like it's made huge, huge advancements in terms of who drinks it. And then we started a blockchain ticketing company that we thought was really interesting because for us, we were just seeing an industry plagued by so many problems due to its archaic platform. And we wanted to create a better experience for our fans and for the other artists out there in the world. And that's also led us now to our fund.
Meanwhile, your day job was also well-paying from what I understand. Forbes said in 2019 that you guys pulled down $46 million through your concerts.
Yeah, we're really fortunate. We were so inspired by dance music. But when we started, that was a genre that was just gaining popularity. It depends on who you ask where it originated. Some people say the US, some people say Europe. But at the time, the majority of big artists in the space were all European. But it was becoming super popular in the US. And we were lucky enough to break through at a moment where it became the dominant genre in music in the world, or at least in younger culture. We were fortunate enough to ride that wave of something that everyone wanted to go see. And it's such an international genre. We're really fortunate that we get to almost like triple dip on the live touring market. For example, last year, we did 50 shows a year at the Wynn in Vegas. But on top of that, we did a 42-city arena tour in North America. And then we spent the summer flying back and forth between Vegas and Europe and Asia as well, just doing festivals. So I think we did about 180 shows last year.
And it also seems like your ascendance in the industry really coincided with the ascendance of social media. You guys were very unique in the way in which you took advantage of social media to propel your music.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. It felt impossible to break through. And Alex and I had to get really clever how we were going to market ourselves when we had no label interest. And there was this website called Hype Machine, which is a blog aggregator. It was the first viral chart of the internet. We started by reaching out to all the artists that were already being blogged on the chart and asking them if we could do a free remix. It did a couple of things for us. We were remixing artists that were already popular on the internet. And then Alex would go on the back end of Hype Machine and reach out to every single kid that wrote every blog that Hype Machine combed music from. And we'd write these hysterical promotional emails. It wasn't a blanket BCC situation. It was like, hey, Chris, your blog's pretty ridiculous, but we thought we would write you this email anyway. I saw you posted this person, so I thought maybe there's a slight chance you'd be interested in us. And ended up within the first 6 months of our career forming these super strong relationships with pretty much every blog just from keeping it real with them. And I think we had probably a stronger promotional platform than any label could offer us within the first 6 months of our career because of kind of the way we approached that.
So in addition to your film production company, your tequila brand, listeners may not realize you've been investing in startups from what I understand all along.
It was probably a few years into our career when we began angel investing for the first time. We have a terrific business manager, Josh Klein, who's been with us from the start. Poor guy. in the beginning, naturally, as we gained popularity, brands and products and people started to reach out to us to be involved. One of the first investments we ever made was in this company called Ember that's actually doing terrific still to this day. And I'd like to say that we were thinking in this incredible way about the business at the time, but we're just like, this is a really great product. We love the founder and let's make an investment. Why not? Our business manager was like, you should look at passive revenue streams and way to invest your money that you're going to be making. And that was one of the first ones you did. And it actually looks like it's going to be a big winner ultimately. But at the time, it was really inbound stuff that was coming our way, which was exciting. But naturally, all that stuff was aligned along the lines of how can the chain smokers as celebrities support this on social media or whatever, you know, in very obvious ways. And we got into some very diverse deals at the time, but it was really all inbound. It wasn't until probably about 2 years ago that we decided to change our strategy and go seek out the opportunities that we thought were out there. That's when we met Milan, who's also on this call, and Jeff, who are the other two GPs in Mantis. And we noticed that we were getting a lot of favorable terms into deals that were really hot that didn't have allocations for other people. And then we also took a real interest in helping those companies succeed, not really from a social media standpoint, but getting our hands dirty with them. And that's when we thought maybe if we institutionalize this process, there's a lot more opportunity out there for us to work with really dynamic founders and interesting businesses that are going to change the landscape of tomorrow. Although obviously the world's in a crappy place, I feel like it couldn't be better timing to be doing that stuff right now.
Hi, Milan. Tell me how you guys all came together to decide on who was going to be managing the day-to-day of this operation.
Yeah, it was actually really organic. Jeffrey, the other partner in the GP, and myself, we conceptualized a fund in partnership with an influencer, but not for the sake of the celebrity, but because we were looking for someone that was actually naturally involved in startup investing in the first place and that has a very extensive network that other VCs can't bring to the table. And then through Josh Klein, Juice and Alex Business Manager, we all ended up meeting up and it was very clear that we all had the same vision of starting a fund and actually wanting to add tremendous value to companies. And so we probably took a year or a year and a half to get to know each other and really feel out what deals we like, how we liked to work with founders. And it turns out we were all aligned. So it was pretty much a match made in heaven.
That's great. And then Milan, before co-founding Mantis, you were working with Eric Moore of Base Ventures. Is that correct?
Yeah, totally. So I was in VC. I've always been an early stage guy since 2013. So I was with Base at first, and then I was running an accelerator program where we would source companies from hackathons, which I thought was really interesting. So we did that, scaled it to 52 countries globally. And that was essentially the intersection of like, okay, now I'm at a pre-seed level, meeting all these great entrepreneurs and founders. How can we actually help them out and add value? We ended up licensing that to Fortune 500 companies, did a bunch of work with them. And that's when I wanted to get back to investing. So it was just a natural progression.
By the time this runs, you guys will have talked at Disrupt and will have announced that you just closed a $35 million fund. You talked to my former colleague, Katie Roof, now at Bloomberg in May, about a $50 million fund. Was that too ambitious in this market or why the discrepancy ultimately?
We were targeting 30. That was our target raise. Mm-hmm. And the LPA stated that we can go up to 50. And we just decided that it's better for a first-time fund. In order for us to be able to produce great IRR for our LPs, we just rather stick to the target. And we're already a little oversubscribed.
They also call this a crypto fund.
because I saw that you gave CoinDesk an interview. And so I think people maybe assumed, and they saw that Yellow Heart is built on a blockchain. And I do want to know, how interested are you in crypto stuff versus the music industry? What are you looking for exactly?
There's so many applications of frontier technology like crypto and blockchain that can be used towards the future to create better systems and services. So for us, it's really about how you apply that technology in a consumer-facing way. A lot of the people we've spoken to that are the older guard, like turned off by the idea of what blockchain and crypto is. We see the opportunity there, but we also understand that the consumer doesn't really care how they get from A to Z. They just want to get there more efficiently and have a better experience. And I feel like some of those things can provide a better experience. In the case of Yellow Heart, which is our blockchain ticketing platform, we found a way to control the secondary ticket market, which plagues our fans with higher costs and fees, and also like bring the ticketing experience and the show experience into the 21st century with a much more dynamic vision for how that process is. And then even in light of COVID, a lot of the people that go to shows, tickets are passing through three or four different people's hands. You don't even know who's in your seat. So from an artist's perspective, it's a powerful tool to know, hey, this person's come to six of our shows. We should reward them for that. But on the flip side, you also, from a health standpoint, get to know who's in your shows in case something happens. So we think there's a lot of powerful applications of this technology that can be really important. But again, it's just important that it's used in a consumer-facing way.
Can you maybe make clear for listeners what Yellow Heart does? It helps the event initiators set up the rules for how their tickets are resold.
Well, what happens in the current ticketing system is a ticket's created by the promoter in partnership with the artist, and then it's sold, and then it's gone. You can't control where it goes. You can't control how many times it's resold. You can't control who buys it. And that's obviously created a multi-billion dollar problem for the music industry. Those tickets get resold for multiples of the price that the artist and the promoter participate on. The fan gets ripped off. We have no idea who's coming to our shows because it's changed hands so many times, like Alex said. If it's on a blockchain, if it's on a ledger system, you retain ownership of the ticket technically, and you can see where it goes and you never lose sight of it, and you can control how many times it's resold and how much it's resold for, amongst a bunch of benefits that Alex touched on.
It's really not meant to eradicate the secondary ticket market. It's like you're licensing your ticket out. And what I think is so cool about Yellow Heart in particular is that you can provide an opportunity. So let's say we sell tickets for $50 and then they're sold for $100. We can decide where that $50 goes. So it could all go to charity automatically, just sent directly to a charity of your choice. It could go 50% back to the artist and 50% to the promoter. You can decide those things in advance. And I think that is a really interesting idea that will create an entirely new ecosystem and opportunity for the artists and fans to do really important things for society.
And there's no change of behavior required on the part of fans to buy these tickets. They don't have to be a hacker to buy them.
No, that was our most important aspect. Because, I mean, even when we started the company with Josh Katz, Drew and I were new to blockchain. We weren't specialists in it. We were like, how hard is this going to be for a fan? Do they have to have some key around their neck? To us, that was the most important aspect, where it's like, you wouldn't even know that you were using blockchain. And I feel like right now we can change things dramatically because there is no new normal anymore. Sometimes those things that are so obvious are the hardest things to get across the line. It's like the switch of a BlackBerry to an iPhone. When we all had BlackBerries, we were like, this is great. I'm never switching. And then someone's like, I got an iPhone. You're like, nope, I don't want to hear it. And then you use an iPhone and you're like, oh, damn, this is pretty nice.
The overlap with Yellow Heart and what you guys do is so clear. It's your audience and you're helping to ensure that you have more control over the secondary market. Where do you guys fit in when it comes to LoanSnap, which is a mortgage lending startup investment that you're leading with True Ventures?
Yeah, so LoanSnap obviously is a less obvious alignment with who the Chainsmokers are. Essentially, it's an AI that operates on blockchain to process loans quicker than any other lender. We have been tracking that company for 6 months. We thought it was really fascinating. And we ended up leading the round with True Ventures because it created a massive press opportunity for LoanSnap at a time when COVID was hitting and there was going to be billions of dollars in refinancing going on that they wanted to participate in. We've been really great partners to them, and we're very close with Carl, the founder, also just brilliant guy. You want to be on his team. In relation to the Chainsmokers, we had this lunch with Jimmy Buffett pre-COVID. He's a very successful businessman, which you probably know, but he's always created things for his fans over their life cycle. Now his fans are 67 years old, and he was talking about creating Margaritaville retirement communities, which was really an interesting concept that stuck with us with a business like LoanSnap. When we started, our fans were primarily all in college 8 years ago. But now they are dealing with paying back their college loans, and they're probably applying to buy their first house. And so a company like LoanSnap feels like one of those services our fans have grown into needing.
That is pretty fascinating. And Carl Jacob is a big deal. I mean, I remember when he started Keen a million years ago, and he's been involved with many, many companies, the founder of LoanSnap. Who brought that deal to you, or did you find it? And also, how do you know the guys at True Ventures? Is that a Kevin Rose connection?
We met Carl through Peter Pham, actually. Alex and Drew had a show in LA in, I believe it was October or November. And so we brought Peter Pham there, and we all hung out. And then a couple of days later, he just shot me a WhatsApp message. He was like, oh my God, like, you should meet this guy, Carl. He's a brilliant guy. So we had lunch in LA, and it was just a great vibe. And he's a brilliant entrepreneur, and we just really had a good feeling about him. And then we just continued the conversation. The timing was just right when COVID hit around March. Mm-hmm. And so over time, we just built this relationship. And then he actually proposed to us that we could co-lead the round with True Ventures. So he essentially made that connection.
Okay, great. I just was wondering what it says about your process. How much is going to be inbound versus outbound? Also, what the decision-making process looks like. So, Milan, you talk to Peter, you get this deal, you present it to Alex and Drew, and then how do you collectively decide to move forward or not? Is it one person feels very strongly about things it's a go, or is it majority rules?
It's actually pretty unique. So all of us have to really want to do the deal. The reason being is that we all have very complementary skill sets. Joe and Alex being angel investors very successfully, and tastemakers as well. And then I come from a more traditional VC background. And then Jeffrey Evans is the serial entrepreneur operator guy. So we think that it's very important to value everyone's opinions. And so we will never do a deal if three people are for it and one person doesn't like it. We are very much relationship driven. So there's both inbound and outbound. We just surround ourselves with friends that have been in the industry for a long time that are veterans. And we obviously trust their first opinion, and then we will vet the deal, build a relationship with the founder over time. So we don't really try to just jump into deals. And one of the most important factors there for us evaluating whether or not it is a fit is if we can add strategic value. And I'll let Alex and Drew touch on how we do that.
Yeah. The big part of when we started fundraising was curating a family of individuals. So much of what we've done is entertainment, obviously, but a large part of what you don't see is really about hospitality, not just for our fans, but for the people that we play the shows for, come backstage. And we've always really enjoyed that process and valued those relationships. We're very much relational people versus transactional people. So it was very evident when we started fundraising that we could really curate a list of industry leaders from different respective fields, not just to help us make calculated decisions and invest with us, but to also use their networks to add value into the investments we make. We were always very clear about that, that we wanted to create that family environment, which is also why I think our fund size is really nice. When we entered the space, it was really about being complementary to other VCs. We wanted these more established, successful firms to see us as great partners, people they wanted to help fill out the round with and invest alongside them, and see our money as being a little bit different than the traditional angel investor or VC firm. And so that's how I think we really fit into the space. And then in terms of value adds, those things can be more abstract. Drew mentioned the Loan Snap case earlier for FitOn, which is a really exciting deal that we're getting into. We squeezed into their A round after it had already closed. We're going to be doing some video stuff with them because Drew and I love working out. It's really exciting for us because it fits right into what we're doing. But Drew and I have acknowledged that we're going to give up opportunities in our chain smoker career, maybe endorsements, in order to benefit the investors in our fund and the companies we want to invest in.
So if you could back up a second, I don't know what FitOn is.
It's a digital fitness platform.
Oh, okay, great.
Is it like a mirror or a Tonal?
There's no hardware, but yes, they lead classes. The platform's outstanding. They've been incredibly successful so far, even before COVID. And again, great founders that we really believed in. And that's who we made the move.
And what size deals are you typically looking to invest in? What are typical check sizes that you envision?
We're usually writing anywhere from $250,000 to $500,000 checks. We're not really looking to lead rounds. As Alex mentioned earlier, we're looking to be a partner with a more established VC, as we're new to the space and we want to be good partners to everybody, VCs included. And that's where we sit.
It sounds like you look at deals through the prism of your audience and try and think about what would be helpful to them, whether it's mortgages or tickets. What other areas are really interesting that you think could help your audience and help your fund?
Yeah, we've been speaking a lot about helping content creators get paid. A lot of the platforms everyone's posting to and participating on right now don't compensate people for creating the content. That marketplace exists off the platform and is controlled by agencies and managers and agents. And I think there's going to be a big opportunity for this next wave of kids that are making these videos or profiles that have millions and millions of views to get paid for those and compensated. It seems that YouTube is the only one that's created a revenue model to compensate content creators. And I think there's a big opportunity there.
We've been selling product to Gen Zs and millennials for the last 8 or 9 years. And it's really given us a great understanding of what their values are and the things that are important to them. And as we look forward, they have a totally different set of values compared to the boomer generation, things that are important in climate, the impact of businesses on their neighborhoods and stuff like that. So we've made a few investments in the companies that are there to service the less established. Like if you unionize the independents around the country and give them a voice, that's an area that's really interesting to us that companies like Placepool and Marble are looking into.
You have time right now to be thinking about startups. What happens when you're touring, you're doing 100 shows again? How does this fit into your workflow?
First of all, I don't know when things are coming back online. And when they do, they won't come back all at once. I'll definitely have a more clear answer for you when things start happening again. But I do think that there's a huge benefit of Alex and my tour schedule that it really allows us to be in a bunch of places. We're traveling all the time. That allows us to meet founders and create this really unique experience for them to meet us and other VCs and us to be connected with many more people in the business. I think the Vegas residency is great for that. It's a quick flight from here. Everyone goes there all the time. It's been a very powerful tool for us to connect people and make introductions and create a very unique experience that I don't know where you can get anywhere else. And so I really think that there's a lot of benefits from us coming back online and moving around all the time.
Can I just ask a quick question about the fund? Is it primarily comprised of family offices and individuals, or are there also institutions that are involved?
Primarily individuals.
And then guys, I did want to ask just for the fans, do you have any idea when you're going to release your fourth album?
Next year. Yeah, next year.
Well, guys, thank you so much.
Yeah,
really
you.
A pleasure to talk to you. And I'm excited that I'll get to talk to you again.
Hell yeah. Thank you so much, Connie and Alex.
It's the end of our show, which is about technology and investment, but we would like to say a word about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and how sorry we are at her loss. She truly was a force of nature, and she will be missed.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you back here next Friday.